You're listening to Simpler One Earth Living from Jubilee One Earth Economics and Simple Living Works with co-hosts Lee Van Ham and Jerry Iverson. Today we feature a conversation with George Gastel. Having served on his school board and city council, George urges us to make an impact for good through our local governments. Greetings, Lee, from Paso Robles, California, and Simple Living Works.
Likewise to you, Jerry. Greetings from San Diego and Jubilee One Earth Economics. George, I've known for some years now, and I'll just speak briefly about him. He's a member of the San Diego Jubilee Circle, and he's a history teacher at San Diego State University, as well as Grossmont College, Palomar College. He teaches American history, Western civilization, world history, California history. He also teaches U.S. history for teachers. He's just a very accessible person and lives his convictions very simply in his expressions in daily life and how he serves the local community. So I'm just delighted that we've had this chance to talk with George and share him with our listeners. So let's just go to the interview and listen to him.
Today, this podcast is about our power that we have through our local governments. I'm not sure if you think of it that way, but your local government is probably the place where you have maybe the most political, a place where you can best exercise your power most effectively, even though the national headlines are more apt to grab, the national government is more apt to grab the headlines. We're going to talk about local government, and we're doing it with George Gastel, that's G-A-S-T-I-L, who can introduce himself here and why he would be the one for this podcast. But George, I just want to welcome you to this podcast for Simpler One Earth Living.
Hi, it's good to be here.
Yeah, so just tell us about your involvement in local government and what motivates you and so on.
Well, I was a school board member and a city council member, and I've been active in my local government for many years. I think my interest developed when I was really young. My mother was elected to the school board in La Mesa Spring Valley, and it's funny, people don't believe me, but I actually knew I was going to be a school board member before I knew what I would be doing that would actually earn a living.
Okay.
I managed to get elected to my own school board in Lemon Grove on the second try, and I served 10 years mm-hmm. on the Lemon Grove School Board from 1998 to 2008. And then after about 10 years on the school board, I felt that the city of Lemon Grove, I live in Lemon Grove, Lemon Grove School District and city of Lemon Grove, I felt that the school district was in good shape. Of course, I'd been helping the school district for 10 years, and I felt like I'd done a lot of good work for the school district. I really felt the city needed better leadership, and I thought I could offer something with my experience. And I ran for city council and actually ran against two incumbents. And people said, it's hard to beat incumbents. I said, well, the thing here is that the incumbents don't like each other, and their supporters don't like the other supporters. So there's a chance for me to get in there. And that proved actually to be true. I got elected to the city council, and I served 2 terms or 8 years on the city council. I would say that both school board and city council are very rewarding, very exciting things to do. They're very different. Both have 5 people. That's one thing they have in common in a small jurisdiction, at least in California. One key difference is on the school board, we had five people that were all focused on education. We all had a connection to the school district. I think all of us had had kids go to school. I actually had kids going to school in the school district when I ran for school board, which is pretty common. The usual pattern is that people get elected while their kids are in the school district, and then they keep serving until long after their kids have graduated. And I guess that might have been part of my reason for switching to city council, because my kids were moving on. But in any event, we tended to have a lot in common. We were focused on the school district, we were all involved in the school district, and we had very similar philosophy about bridging the achievement gap, promoting the effective use of technology, things like that, that were very important to our school district at the time. On the city council, I never felt there was a unifying vision at all. Mm. I never felt that there was one concept of what the city even should be. Some people seem to see it as a service provider for police and fire protection and not much else. Other people saw it as a catalyst for economic development. I tended to be one of those people. And other people saw it as a community organizing tool. I tended to be one of those people. I didn't feel like there was one clear vision of what the city even was, or what it should be, or how it should connect with the residents. And things that were just really taken for granted on the school board, like common vision and who you serve and what the goals are, were really missing in the city council. And that's both for better and for worse. On the school board, we tended to work together, which is almost always a good thing. I used to joke that there was one time there was a 4-1 vote where I was on the losing side, and the funny thing was that a few months later I agreed with the other four people. and based on that experience, I tended to listen to people and think about what they were saying, and I'm sure they were listening to me too. And we really didn't have a lot of 3-2 or 4-1 votes once in a while. We usually talked things out until we all agreed. And I would even compromise with people, to try to get 5 votes, because I thought that was the best thing for the community. On the city council, it was very, very different. On the city council, we would just try to get something done and 3 votes, if that's what there was. Just something, trying to move things along. I didn't feel that there was nearly as much common vision. There were 3 of us that worked together quite a lot. Two of the more experienced council members and me. By the time I left, I was one of the more experienced ones as well. Yeah, there were 2 others. The mayor at the time, Mary Sessom, and a councilman named Jerry Jones that I had known because we'd both been on the school board, but then he jumped to the city, and then later I jumped to the city. So we had that in common. And the mayor had started out with school district stuff too, but she was in PTA, and then she wasn't a school board member, but she had started out her involvement with the district and then had become involved in the city. So we all had that in common, that we'd started with schools and then had switched to municipal stuff as our focus. And the 3 of us worked together pretty well, and I think we got a lot done. Yeah, we got a lot done, and it was never easy. And there was another council member that came on board after my first term. I got reelected and ran together with another council member, or I should say new council member. And that took an interesting twist, because we both got elected. It was a campaign that had a lot of energy, wanting to broaden the vision of the city, make it more focused on organizing the community, more focused on being an economic catalyst, things that I had been talking about. And then there's a saying, be careful what you wish for. my friend that I campaigned with ended up being antagonistic to the 2 other council members that I'd been working with. Make a long story short, I ended up running for mayor in 2016, and my friend was the other candidate for mayor, and it was a very close election that I nearly won. But, as they say, come in close counts in horseshoes and hand grenades. In local government, being the guy that almost got elected mayor it's a little bit of an honor, I guess. It's a little bit better than if I'd never even run. But in any event, it was a good run. 10 years on the school board, 8 years on the city council. The part that I'm not going to say I regret it because I'm glad I was there, but the part that wasn't enjoyable, that I really don't think was positive, was the budget crisis of 2003 and the budget crisis that came with 2008 to 2012, that came with the Great Recession. And two budget crises that were really severe in the school district. In 2003, we had to lay off employees. We had to make terrible cuts. And one of the things that there's so many memories that I sometimes wish I didn't have, but I'm actually glad I do because it's important to learn these things. One of the memories I have though is that the teachers actually would go to court to try to defend their jobs, and they'd end up working against each other. And that was hard to watch. And that there's some things that you can't really be prepared for, like the fact that it's bad enough that you have to make cuts when you're on a school board, but you don't actually get to control who's cut. And sometimes it goes in front of an administrative law judge. Oh my gosh. And and something I had to explain to people at the time, one of those things that you don't really feel there's ever a satisfactory explanation for, is why were there far more pink slips than we could possibly have been laid off? You know, for every teacher you expect to lay off, you have to send about 3 pink slips because you don't actually know which teachers you're going to lay off until an administrative law judge makes a ruling. And it's way more complicated. I would say Byzantine, except that, frankly, I think that empire is a little better than people give it credit. But seriously, the things like that are somewhat distasteful. But it's important to just hang in there and do the work, you know. There was one school board member who wouldn't vote for any cuts, or let alone a layoff, and she just would vote against every budget cut. And I didn't feel that was workable. I didn't really approve of the budget cuts, but if you don't have the money, you don't have the money. And if you don't run your school district, the county board of education will run it for you. And I didn't think that would serve anybody's interests. Not that the county board wasn't good people, but I felt like we should take care of our issues. And if that means that means laying people off, we have to just explain that these are good people and this is a loss. You know, there's no other way to say it. But the budget crisis when I was on the school board, budget crisis when I was on the city council, that's what makes government not fun, and that's the part that I really would have skipped if I could have. But at the same time, I have to say that I'm glad I was there. And what I mean by that is that as bad as it was, the thing that I remember that's really positive is that people were working together to get out of the situation and to handle it as best we could. And I remember it was unpleasant, but I also remember that there was a feeling that we will get through this. When we were on the school board, we believed in our teachers, we believed in our staff. And if we didn't have the money to keep them working, we just said, you know what? We just don't have it, you know. And we have, you know, and tried not to get into a discussion about who's more valuable. Mm-hmm. And just they're all valuable. They're all doing work, or we wouldn't have hired them. And in the city, the same thing. All our city workers were hardworking people. They were all doing important jobs. It was very hard to say who would be laid off. The school district, they had unions, and they had lots of rules, and there's an administrative law judge involved, at least one point. And the city, very different. Very different. The firefighters have a union, but our municipal employees didn't, and it was really just up to us. And the more responsibility than I even wanted, but at the same time, somebody has to make those tough decisions.
I want to just interject here, George. I mean, for those of you who don't know, George is a history professor. And so we just got a wonderful lesson in local government out of his own personal experience. And one of the questions I'd like to have you pursue with you a little further is the question of how state and federal governments were impacting local government. I think you already gave us a couple clues. The budget cuts for the school district, that wasn't just local, I don't think. And then, of course, the recession of 2008 certainly wasn't local. But maybe you want to say more about those, or just other ways that you are working locally to interface, sometimes counter, sometimes benefit from what higher branches of government are giving.
Oh yeah, the state and federal governments have more power over the schools and the cities than most people realize. It's the state government in particular is the primary funding source for public schools in California. And you folks might know the history of Proposition 13, the tax measure that passed in 1978, and there have been other big pieces of legislation usually passed by the voters, that have created the environment that we're in. The school districts get to hire people. And the school districts can mold a vision. They have a lot of control over curriculum up to a point. But the state has incredible power because that's where most of the money is coming from. And the legislature has made it their business in many cases to tell us what to teach and how to teach. And that's not all bad. You know, one thing people find interesting is that state law requires that schools teach the history of LGBT movements. And state law, it was really specific on one thing I find interesting. The Filipino involvement in the United Farm Workers is actually specified as a topic that must be taught in public schools. I was like, that's a little more specific than I would probably be, but you know, there, you look at the history and there's a reason, you know, there's a reason for everything, and you know, it's all inspired by experiences and concerns that people have had. As a teacher of California history, I do talk a lot about the Filipino involvement in that famous Delano strike, but it's funny that would actually be required. You know, that sort of thing is be specified in state laws. I'm not sure the state law needs to be that specific, but in any event, the schools rely on the state, and the budget crises usually have their origins in things happening at a state level. Sometimes that's the state issues are really at a national level, like in the case of the Great Recession. The sometimes school districts have their own problems that have to do with demographic shifts or bad management in some cases. But the ones that I dealt with were really driven by the state budget and what was happening with the state budget. In 2003, it was the great economy of around 2000 had definitely was not with us anymore, and the state just wasn't collecting as much money, you know, and education is popular. People will always say they want to spend more on education, but the truth is that there's only so much money, and when the state has less money, that usually means there's less for education. And at the local level, there's a lot of choice about how to spend it. We have a lot of tough decisions. One thing we did was we tried to keep budget cuts away from the classroom. It's a little bit of a buzzword, but what that meant was that we wanted teachers in the classroom, and some of our classified staff that were involved directly with students. We wanted to keep them in the classroom. We tried to make budget cuts that were outside of the classroom. I would actually make sure people understand that there's so much that happens outside of the classroom that's important. Mm. I mean, the people that work in the cafeteria, you know, and so it's up to a point, you know, up to a point. I mean, it's good to remember that the teachers are the most important thing, you know, the people that work directly with the students, mm-hmm. but only up to a point. I mean, you need janitors and you need people working in the cafeteria and they have to earn a living. So I'd say only up to a point. You know, it's good to remember that that you're delivering education, obviously, but it's really so much more. School is more. It's an environment. It's a community.
I want to interject again here, George. Thanks for your comprehensive answers to these on these issues. There's lots to learn, and if all of us translate what George is saying into our own specific context, there's lots here for us to take away.
We'll return momentarily to our conversation with George Gassel. The Amazon is in the news, and not in a good way. Oh my goodness, the destruction going on there, even the leaders at the G7 nation, excluding President Trump, who didn't attend that meeting, talked about it and committed £20 million to putting out the fires and taking care of the Amazon. It's a great response to the irresponsibility of the Brazilian president. So what do we do about this? Well, I want to say that with trees burning, let's plant trees. I know it's small compared to the Amazon, but let's make it part of a big picture, which is the report that came out a month or so ago to plant 1 trillion trees by 2030. And if we plant 1 trillion trees, we will reduce the CO2 in the air by somewhere between 25% and 50% and help keep the Earth livable. So how do you do it? Well, calculate. Find a calculator online, the one at terrapass.com/carbon-footprint-calculator is a good one. You may find one you like better. Find out how much your travel is, how much CO2 your travel is putting into the air, whether it's car or plane. You've been traveling this summer, so find out how much CO2 you've put into the air. The calculator translates it into dollars, and then donate that amount to the Jubilee Economics Tree Fund. There are other funds too, of course, but in Jubilee, the Jubilee circles in Mexico and in San Diego are all working with trusted groups to plant trees. So let's respond very concretely to the Amazon fires in that way. Well, now let's return to our conversation with George Gasol.
I think you've made pretty clear the value of the local government, and even though it's impacted by lots of things from the outside. Okay, so someone wants to be a little more involved in, say, local government. For you, it sounds like you had a mom who was very involved, so that was a high motivator. But what are some of the ways, short of running for election, though not exclusive of that, that one can do valuable things by way of influence and, you know, impact for the, I guess the greatest impact for the least effort is sort of one way to say it.
Well, actually, I would encourage people to not try to have the most impact for the least effort, because because one thing I can tell you, of someone who served in government, and also I worked for two legislators, is that we always notice how much effort people are putting in. And whether this is right or wrong, I'm pretty sure this is pretty much universal, that people in government notice how much effort you're putting in, and they judge your message accordingly. And so I would say, you know, handwritten letters or handwritten notes, I should say, or neatly typed letters, you'd be surprised. Some things are still, you know, I guess you could say some things were done best in the mid to late 20th century, like the letter on letterhead with your own signature, followed up by a phone call. I mean, there's things that just, like, people figured this out in the 1970s, and it still works, you know. And meeting with your local legislators. You don't need to go to Sacramento. You can meet them in their district office when they're in town. You go to Sacramento if you want to see the Capitol, you know, and you know, it's like a museum trip. The thing I would tell people, if they want to be involved in local government in particular, is to get to know your local government. You don't need to go to a lot of school board meetings or city council meetings. Honestly, I hardly ever went to either of those until I got elected. And most people won't admit this, but I really don't go to city council now that I'm not serving anymore, except I've been a couple times. If there's an issue that's important, or if they're recognizing something that I've done. I didn't go to very many school board meetings before I was on the school board. I figured that's their job. I went to a few to learn about what they were doing. I think that the key is to learn how your government works, and if you have a concern, to talk to the people that can do something about it. And sometimes people will talk to city staff, and they don't realize that city staff have discretion. And they have input, but they don't have policy authority. And elected officials have policy authority. So sometimes you need to talk to both. Sometimes you talk to staff about the particulars, or maybe just to find out what's going on, maybe to get the basic information. Because if you live in a small jurisdiction, your elected officials are part-time people, and they will just refer you to staff for information and that kind of thing, or at least I always did. But on policy, the elected officials make the decision. So sometimes you need to talk to both, and I'd get to know your local people. Go to candidate forums and hear them speak and ask questions and maybe support one or two of them. You don't need to. You get involved in every race and, you know, and back a slate of people that, you know, agree with you or anything like that. Just get involved in, you know, one or two races with people you know, people you believe in, and you'll start meeting all the other people.
Let me ask, let's supposing that, I want to say too, Lemon Grove, the jurisdiction, 30,000 people, is that right?
It's 26,000.
26,000, okay. And the school district?
School district has about 30,000.
Okay.
School district's a little bit bigger than the city. School district has a piece of La Mesa, and it has a little piece of San Diego City, and has a tiny piece of unincorporated Spring Valley.
Just wanted to give our listeners kind of a sense of that. Then, two, supposing I'm in a community where I really have quite a progressive way of thinking compared to what a lot of the people around do, and I feel like the local government is really lagging. Do you have thoughts about how to work with that?
Oh yeah. I've gotten to know some of the folks. I remember once somebody came to the city council wanting us to pass a resolution to repeal Citizens United, the Supreme Court decision. And some people at the time said, well, that's not really City of Lemon Grove business, is it? I felt that it was, because it's about government and how people relate to their government. I really think people need to be able to use their local government as a forum, because sometimes that's where the discussions can happen. Mm. Kind of like the New England Town Hall. Mm. I can remember in the 80s, New England Town Halls were debating whether to have a nuclear freeze, you know. Mm. And some people would say, we're a little town in Vermont. Why are we talking about nuclear weapons? Mm. You know, but I think that it's analogous. I think that people need a forum, and sometimes it's good to have your local elected officials make a statement, and Lemon Grove did in fact make a statement supporting the repeal of the Citizens United decision. But it's never easy, because one thing you have to remember is that people get elected to the city council usually to fix streets or make sure that the parks are clean. Sometimes there's something going on in their specific community, and that's really where most of the action happens. People generally don't run for city council, because they're going to advocate for a national assault weapons ban or something of that nature. And I usually don't vote for candidates that are talking about national and international things, because my feeling is, well, go volunteer for Peace Resource Center, you know, or run for Congress, and you know, but there is a place for it. There is a place for it. I think that you just have to be mindful that about 90-95% of the business in a city really has to be local, and it really has to be the small day-to-day things. Mm-hmm. Another approach that sometimes people have that I think is really noteworthy is to connect the local and the global. You know the cliche, think globally, act locally. So the climate change, for example, yes. if we're building mass transit and we're building housing that's close to mass transit, we're probably doing something positive to minimize our impact, that's an example of finding a way to work locally on something that's of global significance, mm-hmm. and seeing the real connections. The one caution on that, though, is that, you know, it's good to be mindful that a city of 26,000 people is not going to solve the climate crisis. And probably most people in Lemon Grove are going to be more concerned about how they can get to their jobs or how much it's going to cost to live in the city or whether they're going to move somewhere else. And so you kind of have to reach people where they where they are. But you know, but it's there's no harm in connecting the two things. I mean, we should all be concerned about the global climate crisis, just as, and we should all be concerned about how we're going to get to work. You know, it's not like those are two conflicting concerns. It's two things that two different concerns that we can have at the same time.
As I understand it, as an example of what you're saying, in the San Diego region, which of course includes Lemon Grove, the biggest contribution we can make to the reduction of greenhouse gases is in the area of transportation. My understanding is that it's something like 70% of our contribution to greenhouse gases are in the area of transit. You can correct all that if you wish. But therefore, how we handle transportation that is less centered on an automobile becomes very strategic to both a local and global issue. It all seems to be one.
Yeah, it is. You know, one thing that I feel very good about is that is I teach online, and I thought at first that I would miss the classroom interaction, but well, I do. I mean, but the online has its own. It has its own strong points, and there's wonderful things about teaching online. Students tell me that they participate. Most students participate more online than they do in a regular classroom. And I particularly like the fact that I have a record of everything that people have written online, whereas I am not going to record my classes and listen to a tape of you know, I can't stand my voice on tape anyway, like a lot of people. It's like that, really? That's me. But seriously, teaching online is something that I feel is a really positive step, and I want to encourage people to take courses online. I want to encourage universities to teach more classes online. That, you know, we'll never be able to say we don't need. I mean, obviously, the human personal interaction face to face is valuable, but I don't think that people need to take their whole college curriculum that way.
And is it online courses? I would think. Reduce perhaps some of the need for on-campus parking, or the ecological impacts of traveling to campus and back. I'm not sure. I don't want to exaggerate that, but
the impact is significant. I know that I drive less because I teach online, and a lot of my students will tell you that they drive less because they take courses online. There's no question. This is the kind of thing that we need to do more of. We need to figure out how to make fewer trips. Transit is great, you know. I love the trolley. But really, really, I think the biggest impact over the long run is just to figure out how to make fewer trips. Because human interaction is a wonderful thing, but a lot of us have family, you know, that we live with, or we have neighbors that are next door. Why are we driving all over the county to interact with people when there are people right next to us?
I want to, we'll be winding up this conversation soon, George, and I love where you've taken us. Thank you so much. But I know that in addition, as a little boy, seeing a mom on the school board and having those kinds of influences, you've also had spiritual influences. I think you've been a Quaker your whole life. I know that when it comes to activism, you have a preference for something that could be called perhaps spiritual activism. So kind of as we wrap this up, I would really like to hear how this kind of spiritual path you know, is kind of integrated into your life.
Well, yeah, that's really the theme of the whole thing, isn't it? Yeah, I did grow up a Quaker, and in California, that's something of a privilege. Most California Quakers didn't grow up with Quakerism. My parents got interested in Quakerism before I was born, and so you could even say I had the luxury of growing up with it. And it's a funny way to think of it, but in many ways, because it was around me when I was growing up, I think I'm a little more at ease with it than I would be otherwise. Sometimes I run into people that are new to Quakerism that are concerned that they're not a good enough Quaker. And it's like, there's no such thing. It's like Quaker is someone who goes to meeting, and actually sometimes Quakers miss meeting. So Quaker is somebody that just loves the spiritual presence and who wants to live in the spirit of God. And yeah, so I think maybe it could be because I grew up with it that I don't remember ever worrying about whether I was a good enough Quaker. It's like, if you feel that you're a Quaker, and you do the best you can. But getting to the connection between the religion I grew up with and the activism, to me, the activism is centered on the spiritual aspect, because it's all about living in the presence of God and about seeing that of God in every person. And this is the reason Quakers are against violence, because God is in every person. And the conflict, I'm not sure if they're good and evil or really exist in the way people talk about them, but there's the conflict would be inside each of us. It's not me against some other person. There's going to be good and bad in all of us, and the key is to speak to that of God in everyone, and to nurture the spirit in ourselves. And it's funny because when you explain these things, people just say, "Oh, well, that just sounds like Christianity." And well, I'll let you in on a secret, and Lee knows this is not a secret. Quakerism actually started as what people in the 1600s, many people thought was the most pure form of Christianity. That actually is where it started. So if it sounds like Christianity, we're probably doing a good job. In more recent times, it's become more of a universal faith, with many people who identify as Buddhists or Muslims or some other faith connecting that to Quakerism. As far as activism and spirituality, I have been concerned in recent times, and I know I'm not the only one, that social movements have often lost track of the spiritual dimension that was important in their founding. It's a little bit complicated, so I hope we have a little bit of time left. But I'm not saying that people have to be religious or even spiritual to be in movements. Certainly not. I've known atheists, who have been active in the peace movement and active for social justice, who've done more than I have. But I think that the peace movement, social justice movements, I think that historically they have actually been grounded in spirituality and in the community associated with a religion, and that's given them a lot of strength. And as they develop outside of spirituality, it's a tricky thing, because I would never tell anybody that they have to be spiritual to be a peace activist. No, it's far from it. But I do think that the movement has to, the movements have to recognize where they draw energy and where the vision is sustained. So maybe it's a case where not every peace activist is going to be spiritual, but many of us are, in fact, for many of us, the peace activism is grounded in spirituality, or it might be grounded in a community, a religious community, that it feeds from. So I think maybe the recognition, and I think it helps if people are comfortable with that. And speaking as somebody coming from the Quaker peace movement and Quaker movements for social justice, I think that those of us that do identify with a religion, I think we need to be very open to the fact that the many people who don't have a religion, who don't connect themselves to a faith community, who are just as effective in the movements. Mm. So it's a two-way street.
I wanted to say I think we are going to stop here for today, but the whole issue that we have ended on here could be a nice long 30-minute conversation, and maybe we'll just do that one of these times. It seems to me too that some liberal movements have been so skittish around spirituality and even repressive of it, and I think it has weakened the movement, whereas something like what the civil rights movement was, which was so deeply deep in spirituality through Martin Luther King, who was always a preacher, that was such a different type of movement. And I hope that as the ecological challenges face, that we'll find a great deal of people who connect their spiritual path to the activism. Mm-hmm.
You've been listening to the second half of our conversation with George Gastel. In future episodes, we'll talk about workforce ownership housing and about Lee's new book, The Liberating Birth of Jesus, Untamed by Christmas. Have you listened to our recent episodes? In May, we heard from Stephen Cornett, a regenerative farmer. In June, Carrie Radloff, Sierra Club activist in Iowa. In July, Michael Patrick White Eagle O'Connor, a Native American artist and earth activist. In August, Lori Payer, leader of Strong Women of the Four Directions. Do listen. You're sure to pick up thoughts you'll value. We certainly did as we created those episodes. Also, please subscribe to my Simpler Living Daily Nudge to get quick reminders of our blogs, our podcast episodes, and other intriguing happenings of events, such as Non-Conform Freely Celebrations, ways to honor rites of passage and holidays without consumerism. Please tell us your thoughts on these subjects. Leave a message on Jubilee One Earth Economics and Simple Living Works Facebook pages. Well, it's time to wrap up this episode. You can subscribe to this podcast under the names The Common Good Podcast and Simple Living Works at your favorite podcast service. Urge your friends to do the same. Until next time, this is Jerry Iverson of Simple Living Works with co-host Lee Van Ham of Jubilee One Earth Economics, wishing you well as we strive together to bring simpler One Earth living into being for the common good.
Learn to live simply so others can live.